In anticipation of this summer's return of Jurassic Park, our first reading is from Michael Crichton's The Lost... You didn't see that coming, did you? It works. Just hang on. The Institute explored the behavior of a great variety of complex systems. Corporations, neurons, enzyme cascades within a single cell, the group behavior of migratory birds. It did not take long before they began to notice that complex systems showed certain common behaviors, behaviors that could not be explained by analyzing the components of the systems. The time-honored scientific approach to reductionism, taking the watch apart to see how it worked, didn't get you anywhere with complex systems because the interesting behaviors seemed to arise from the spontaneous interaction of the components. The behavior wasn't planned or directed, it just happened. Of the behaviors, two are of particular interest. One is adaptation. The ability to adapt is a characteristic of complex systems and may be one reason why evolution seems to lead towards even more complex organisms. But even more important is the way complex systems seem to strike a balance between the need for order and the imperative to change. Complex systems tend to locate themselves at a place we call the edge of chaos. We imagine the edge of chaos as a place where there's enough innovation to keep a living system vibrant and enough stability to keep it from collapsing into anarchy. It is a zone of conflict and upheaval where the old and the new are constantly at war. Finding the balance point must be a delicate matter. If a living system drifts too close, it risks falling over into incoherence and dissolution. But if the system moves too far away, it can become rigid, frozen, totalitarian. Both conditions lead to extinction. Too much change is as destructive as too little. Only at the edge of chaos can complex systems flourish.
In my first few years after leaving home, my mom and I used to have a conversation that we'd repeat every so often. It goes like this. First, I tell my mom what I've been up to, like my classes and my friends or whatever, basically what felt like to me regular chit-chat. And then my mom goes, "You sound weird. You don't sound like yourself." "Who do I sound like, Mom?" "I don't know, like your friends or your professors. I'm not sure, just not like you." This conversation drove me crazy. It drove me crazy that she didn't believe me, that it was me. And I drove myself crazy with the doubts that would creep in as a result. Like, am I not myself? What does my real self sound like? And what does that real self want to do with the rest of her life? The process of figuring out who we are, particularly in relation to our parents, is not a straight line. Even when you think you've gotten it all worked out, something changes, and you got to go through it all over again. Self-definition, as Edwin Friedman calls it, is a lifelong process and a practice that we never really perfect, but we keep trying. However, it's not a process or a practice in the way that a lot of us have been taught or enculturated to believe. A few weeks ago, I spoke about the ways our faith has been shaped by the Enlightenment, that philosophical period of the 18th century that some describe as the turn to the self. As Unitarian Universalist theologian Paul Raiser summarizes, according to this view, the individual becomes a mature self, an autonomous ego, by throwing off the constraints of the social group and breaking free. And importantly for us, he adds, this view expresses the still dominant self-understanding for religious liberals. Okay, so I know you're like evaluating, is this my dominant view? So let's go back and Let me read it again so you can think about this. The individual becomes a mature self, an autonomous ego, by throwing off the constraints of the social group and breaking free. This idea of selfhood is where my mom was coming from, right? That I wasn't being myself because I was too influenced by the views of my social group. I was enmeshed with them. Of course, the self that she was wanting to hear from probably was equally a product of my family as my social group. But we'll come back to that issue in a bit. So this concept of selfhood as a matter of freeing oneself from the influence of others and the idealization of the free, unencumbered individual has motivated and still motivates many of us towards Unitarian Universalism. Because our living tradition affirms individual freedom of belief rather than assent to a shared theological statement, we attract those who yearn to declare their independence as an ultimate fulfillment of what it means to be human. This is liberal religion as an assertion of being made free from. Free from social constraints, free from family pressures, from the religion of our childhood, from dogmatic demands, free from whatever you feel binds you up, keeps you from being your real, true, individual self. Our first principle, the affirmation of the inherent worth and dignity of every person, has often been interpreted from this view of the self, which can be taken as permission for any given individual to be and do whatever they want along their individual path. Taken to the extreme, our first principle can end up acting as authorization for a life that is literally self-centered. But again, all of this depends on this highly individualized and fixed definition of selfhood. Even in the Enlightenment, however, there was some sense that this wasn't right, that this wasn't the full picture. Since then, philosophers like John Dewey, Jürgen Habermas, and more recently, Sally McFaig, and a whole community of feminist, womanist, and postcolonial theologians, all of these have worked to offer an alternative understanding of the self, something Reiser describes succinctly as intersubjectivity. To various degrees, these ideas over the centuries have reimagined the self, not as some kind of fixed, pre-established thing that would ideally be unencumbered by the influence of others, but rather, as Dewey said, always in the process of making and being made in the context of a great web of relationships. As Reiser puts it, in this view of the self, we are not first individuals who then form social groups. Instead, not only do our groups precede us, but we become selves in the first instance through the process of social interaction. I'm going to do that one again, okay? So not only do our groups precede us, but we become selves originally through a process of social interaction. Groups come first, and then selves arise out of groups. In this frame, you can't separate out the individual from their family, their friends, their socio-historical context, their culture. It's all one. Like our reading describes, you can't break down life, this great complex system, into its component parts and hope to learn something more true. The pieces without the whole don't make as much sense. This way of thinking offers an important corrective to our first principle's potential for self-centeredness, right? And instead invites us to think about our first principle in the context of our seventh, affirming we are inherently worthy in the context of the interdependent web of all existence. It's the layering of the two that is important. Though the self is constituted within a greater whole, mature selfhood in this paradigm still requires differentiation, which I know sounds like we're like right back where we started. But the critical difference is that rather than imagining we are born with some preformed self that we must protect from relational interference or infiltration, this so-called infiltration is how we become a person, which then in turn can be differentiated. To put it another way, our interaction with others, sometimes kind, sometimes cruel, always vulnerable, and our mutual transformation in the context of these relationships is not how our self is corrupted, but rather how our self is formed and then developed. And that developing self can in turn be individuated, and the process repeats. Going back to those irritating conversations with my mom, I wasn't not myself. I was simply becoming myself. New social groups, new changing self. Out of our connections and relationships, the systems we connect with are changed. And then those systems that those systems are connected with are changed. And so on and so on. So that across the great web of relationships, we are all always evolving as individuals and as a part of a greater whole. Now, I don't know if this will surprise you, but on this issue of selfhood, Unitarian Universalists are actually pretty conservative. Paul Reiser's book, it's been out for 10 years now, and when it first came out, it was already summarizing theology that was like cutting edge 30 or 40 years before. The most progressive theologians, philosophers, and social scientists have for decades been theorizing out of and promoting ethical paradigms based in this more intersubjective, relational notion of the self that knows there is no I without we. But the way that many Unitarian Universalists, the way we think about ourselves and talk about our lives, how we think about church, and the way we understand who we are together as a congregation, or the ways we imagine how we relate to the rest of the world, our neighbors, and how this thinking guides our actions and our commitments, or how they don't. So much of this remains highly individualistic. Now, you may have noticed it's been a big year for our congregation. Sometimes we have teetered on the edge of chaos, as we've sought a place that will allow us to evolve and adapt in a quickly changing world, and to our own changing community in Larimer County, as it is already and always impacting us and as we impact it. One of the things we've been working through this year, both intentionally and simply as a result of what it means to have a long-tenured minister retire, is an exploration of the relationship between the individual and the community. We've been exploring how our expectations for how we walk together and what our promises are to ourselves and one another and to the wider world. We've been wrestling with who gets to decide what and for whom and why. And we've been saying we a lot, or maybe more than in the past. There is, across all of Unitarian Universalism, an emerging, transforming sense of how we think about the human person, and a move to a more interrelational, communal understanding. And there is a drive to consider ourselves less a bunch of individuals who just happen to gather occasionally, and instead as a complex system, constantly adapting and evolving based on the many layers of interaction that have gone on, do go on, and will go on over time. This reframing hasn't always been easy. Over the past few months, I've heard some wonder if we've abandoned the first principle, or all of them, as they seem to be missing from the order of service. Or even if we have abandoned Unitarian Universalism altogether. I've heard the rumors. But the principles still hang back of the sanctuary and over the water fountain. And more importantly, they still ground us in a shared covenant across our association of Unitarian Universalist congregations, of which we are a part. But I do get how the implications of the shift in how we think about the self and those implications for how we act together, what we expect of each other, how we imagine ourselves together. I get these are significant, and for some can feel threatening to the experience of joy and liberation that they've experienced in this faith, that we've experienced in this faith, that freedom from. And yet, aligning our faith to this more relational understanding of the self as a part of a great web of interdependence, understanding ourselves as both fundamentally interconnected and individuated, emphasizing not just freedom from, but what we are free for. These are critical for us to remain relevant to our still constantly changing world. Hyper-individualized selfhood leaves us lonely and isolated. It taxes the earth's resources unsustainably. It keeps some super wealthy and others starving. And it seriously limits our potential impact to bring greater love and kindness to more of the world, which is what I understand as our entire reason for being. And so let us welcome the edge of chaos, uncomfortable though it can often be. Let us hover there, take up residence, held as we are within this great web, knowing that our interaction, adaptation, and resulting creativity represents our vitality and our infinite possibilities. And began. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles, mend my life, each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough, and a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. I should have called this part the bonus material. It's like on a DVD, the extras. See, I'm not preaching another full sermon until July, so I just had a little more to say on this topic. And I keep hearing this question come up in conversations and meetings in my own life. Have you ever had that experience where it feels like a period of your life, the same basic question is showing up whatever setting you're in? Yeah, so this is a question that directly relates to what it means to be an intersubjective self. So the conversations that I've been having, they start with a description of a problem, usually somebody else's problem. Like, someone is depressed or anxious, unable to find a job, struggling with chronic illness, perpetually angry or disappointed, addicted, enabling, abused or abusing. Maybe you know someone who fits in one of these categories. Now, sometimes you tell me you think you know what that person should do, and you ask, how do I get them to do it? Or maybe you even know how to fix the problem, and you just need a little help yourself. Like, so you ask, can you help me? These conversations travel a path like the one Mary Oliver describes in her poem. We start in the weeds with the voices calling out, mend my life! And we feel our desire to help. The ways their suffering leaves us feeling heartbroken and frustrated, confused. We even feel ourselves like catching their struggles as if they are our own. And we don't usually think of depression or anxiety as contagious diseases, but they sure can be. So eventually, we tend to sort out what's going on, who's actually struggling and why, whose anxiety it really is, whose depression, whose grief, and then the question presents itself. I want to be there for them. I want them to get better. I mean, I might be catching their issues, but I want to help. Isn't that compassion? Isn't that love? In 2008, the Reverend Nick Carter gave a keynote as a part of the UUA's General Assembly about best practices in navigating these tensions of the individual and community. He offered a list of 10 best practices. They're all great, but it's the first of the practices that is my general guiding principle for this question of how to truly help someone else. Basically, his counsel was to stop the common liberal practice of what he calls sloppy agape. Agape, I think it's probably agape, but it rhymes better if you say agape. So agape is the Greek word that Martin Luther King Jr. used to describe the kind of love that we feel for someone simply because they are a part of our one human family. Agape is a good thing, like the best. It holds the power of transformation. But sloppy agape is when we fail to pair that relational self, that sense of being one human family, with the individuated self. It's when we assert the seventh without the first principle. And when we get mixed up on the boundaries of ourself and confuse what is ours with what belongs to someone else. I'm thinking like next fall, maybe all year, but we'll do a series on family systems theory, which is the theory promoted by Murray Bowen and specifically for congregations and leaders by Edwin Friedman. It is the framework that we're kind of swimming in today, both this and the first part of the sermon. But for today, let me say generally that family systems is a frame that always orients towards a family as a whole. The way its members relate to each other, their habits, and generational history, as well as the family's relationship to the larger society around them. In contrast to the focus on any one individual person in and of themselves, which would be like looking at those component parts of a watch. In the congregational setting, the family is the congregation, both as one big system, but also as all the families that constitute the congregation. So families within families. Within this framework, every lesson of this theory is about self-differentiation, which is maybe counterintuitive, right? But here's the idea. In the midst of embracing this fully relational view of selfhood, the key for health and continual positive growth is understanding that the only person you can really change is yourself. The only life you can save is your own. I like many things about that poem from Mary Oliver, but I especially like the way that she doesn't say that at the end. She just ends with saving the only life you can save. If you read the whole thing, you hear that that's what she's up to, saying, right, that's you, yours. But I appreciate the way she leaves it hanging, because for me, I feel like this is a question we run into over and over and over in our lives. You know it, we know it, I know it, and yet still, over and over and over, I ask myself the question, is there a way for me to save them? Maybe just as importantly, however, because there is no isolated self, as we are newly embracing, and as family systems teaches, if you save yourself, you save the whole. Self-differentiation in this model begins by facing your underlying motivations and feelings. It is sometimes not fun, let's say, together. Like, you know, when I'm really doing my work, I groan a lot. You kind of know when you're doing it well, when you go, ugh, a lot. Right? These motivations and feelings have been formed in the context of a web of relationships. And so the job is to make them more conscious, claim them as your own. It means getting clear about what pushes your buttons and why. It means understanding and then interrupting the deep and often multi-generational patterns of your life and attempting to step back enough to try something entirely new. Now, to be clear, self-differentiation does not mean a lack of feeling for another. It simply allows you to walk alongside someone else with care and compassion, with a kind of immunity from catching their stuff. And to help us practice this kind of self-differentiation, I recommend participating in a small group, especially one of our soul circles, where the deep listening is ideal for increasing self-awareness. They also offer a great way to practice both that individuation and continued relational self-development. And you'll get others that are holding you accountable to some of this hard and yet vital work. We'll launch another 4 or 5 groups in the fall. And actually, if you all sign up, then we'll launch like 20. You had the first service. We could do like 40 groups. We'll do it. All sign up. So look for the information in August. Regular spiritual practices, including worship, can be helpful too, as they offer that disciplined practice to help us stay in tune with our big why. While the summer weather beckons, I know sitting together for 1 hour each week, it's like our body starts to remember. You sit in the chair, breathe, and something happens. There's a routine in the singing, the pausing, the being together. If you haven't ever been a regular weekly worship attendee, like, I just try it out. It really does something different than the coming less often. It's just a practice that helps us move from that individualized notion of church to that more intersubjective sense, where we are here for the we as much as for the I. Also this summer, we will offer spiritual practice sessions every other Sunday, so you can stay after the service and just really strengthen yourself for this journey. We are a people we have big hearts, and we want to take care of each other. We do know intuitively, I think, that we are both individuals and we are a part of each other, that we need both, first in the context of seventh principle. But also, though we can be really practiced at the thinking and the theory, some of the actual doing is really hard. It's hard for everyone. So we keep practicing in our actual families and in our congregational family. We keep strengthening our sense of self, breaking old patterns, evolving, and growing together. And with this as our practice, we might imagine ourselves hovering regularly at the edge of chaos, maybe even dancing along the edge.